Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And joining me today, I'm very pleased to say, is one of my TNT colleagues. He is Hroge Morich. He hosts his own show, The Hroge Morich Show, on TNT Radio from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And he also hosts the Geopolitics and Empire podcast, which he founded, another excellent show with many excellent guests. If you're not familiar with Froje's work on TNT or on Geopolitics and Empire, I highly recommend checking it out and getting yourself familiar with it. It provides a wealth of knowledge, and both shows are shows I listen to and watch respectively very often. And again, I'm very pleased to have him with me here today. So without further ado, Hroge, welcome to Perspective. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, it's great to be here and to virtually meet my colleague, my coworker now at TNT. I think you've been at TNT longer than I have. I just finished about a month. I survived a month. And it's so far so good. I'm having fun here at TNT.
Great. Yeah, colleagues and hopefully soon to be friends as well. And you've been doing a great job here at TNT. And I don't say that just to butter you up. You really have amazing guests on, as you do on your Geopolitics and Empire podcast. And I'd love to get a hold of your Rolodex, but you're much more than a presenter. So for listeners who may not be familiar, can you provide a little bit of background into yourself outside of the show work that you do?
Yeah, I've led an interesting life. I was born in Chicago, so I'm a native Chicagoan, and I would consider myself a patriotic American. You know, I believe in Americana. And then we moved a lot. I'm within Illinois, but then I'm also Croatian. My parents are Croatian immigrants from Yugoslavia and ethnically a Croat. My name literally means Croat, translated. Mm. And so we moved back and forth also to Croatia a couple times. I went to school in Croatia, back in the U.S., and then I studied history. And then I went off around 2006. I decided to permanently expatriate from the United States. I think a lot of us, you know, around 2003, 2004, I started to question. I went down the rabbit hole, right? I learned 9/11 was an inside job, you know, loose change. That's a funny story too, though. You know, a lot of us have seen Loose Change, the documentary that I think is the most viewed internet documentary. And it's funny enough, one of our new coworkers on TNT, Michael Parker, who I had interviewed on he had a great show on Lib TV. And then I had him on Geopolitics and Empire last year, and then recently on TNT. And he had produced some music on Loose Change back like in the early 2000s.
Okay.
And now he's got his own show on TNT as well. So now he's one of our colleagues as well. And so, yeah, I watched Loose Change. Then I learned about, you know, the Federal Reserve and all of that. And then I realized, you know, I grew up in America thinking, oh, I'm just, you know, an American, a U.S. citizen, love any other nation. And then I realized America's an empire. You know, I'm a citizen of an empire. And they do things like 9/11 and the Federal Reserve and this oligarchy that controls everything. And I just kind of studying history and all of that, I just kind of got fed up as well with the culture. I became a Christian and I just wanted to seek more higher, you know, intellectual things and spiritual things. And I was just kind of tired of all the people around me just wanting to get drunk all the time, just talk about sports and weather and just trivial things. And I'm like, no, I want to, you know, figure out how the world works, study empire, you know, find God and all of that. And so I just as I realized that this is the American empire, right? And I felt it was declining, so that it was on a permanent economic decline, culturally degenerating. and it would become authoritarian, right? And I think we're seeing this now. So this was 2006. And, you know, we got now the domestic terror units Biden has set up. We've got Americans that are being put on no-fly lists because of their thought crimes, getting their bank accounts closed. They can't use Uber, Airbnb, big tech across the board. They're being deplatformed. And so, yeah, we see this happening. So I left, and then I did Peace Corps Mongolia for a little over a year. I left early. I loved Mongolia. I lived in the yurt in the Gobi Desert. And then I came back briefly to the U.S. And then I did my master's in the Geneva School of Diplomacy a year in Switzerland. Some of my professors included Dutch-American human rights lawyer Curtis Dobler, who was on Saddam Hussein's defense counsel. Arafat's brother, Yasser Arafat's brother-in-law, Ibrahim Sousse, was my professor. Alfred de Zayas, I don't know if you know Alfred de Zayas. He's often on Gray Zone and RT. He was my professor. He's the great grandson of Cuba's president, UN special reporter. And so, I was around these kinds of people. When I graduated, I saw just how corrupt governments were, you know, the international organizations, you know, these globalist institutions. And I didn't have the, I don't know what you call it. Like, I don't want to get involved in this corrupt stuff. And so I just wanted to find a profession where I could not corrupt myself. And I went back into teaching, and I got a job teaching at the top private school, high school and university in Mexico. And I went off to Mexico in 2010. But, you know, that's not to say that we need people, you know, in the governments, in the IGOs, fighting the good fight. I just didn't have the stomach for it at the time. And yeah, I came to Mexico 2010, and I was here ever since. I became a Mexican, a proud Mexican citizen now. So I've got three nationalities. It says it on my TNT bio. And so, yeah, and then I started podcasting, moonlighting just for fun. And yeah, that brings us up to today. I spent 3 years in Kazakhstan from 2017 to 2020. I was working at Nursultan Nazarbayev's intellectual high schools there. And during the pandemic, I fled back to Mexico.
Yeah, I think I was made aware of that, your time in Kazakhstan, yesterday when I watched the interview you recently did on geopolitics and empire with Thierry Meyssan, which is an excellent interview that, again, I highly recommend any listeners who haven't seen it or who aren't familiar with Hrovje's work to definitely check out. And just on the point of your first name, I hope I'm not butchering it too much. How is it correctly pronounced?
You were, but at this point, I don't care. I mean, honestly, okay. I've lived all around the world, and I do it to people. People do it to me. It's Hrvoje.
Okay, Hrvoje.
Yeah, there you go. And in Croatian, it's you say, well, Croatia in Croatian is Hrvatska. And that's why you can see the connection between Hrvatska, Croatia, and Hrvoje. So my name is literally means Croat. So.
Right on. Okay, good to know. I like to be able to pronounce people's names correctly or as closely as possible. If I'm not able to get it right on. But I am half Ukrainian, so I have Slavic heritage as well. Yes, so obviously what's been going on since not just February 24th, but let's start for the sake of this conversation at February 24th. Obviously what's been going on in Ukraine since then has been captivating my attention, like it has been for a lot of people. And it's very personal to me as well, given that my father's side of the family comes from there. But I am of the position that Russia was provoked into taking the special undertaking the special military operation it has, and that one of the things it's doing that I very much stand by is stopping the genocide that's been occurring in Donbass for the past 8+ years. And it's also rooting out Nazis from Ukraine. And these are literal Nazis who trace their lineage, their origins back to people will call him a Nazi collaborator. I call him a Nazi. People like Stepan Bandera, for example, or Andriy Melnyk is another one. And these are elements in Ukraine that are entrenched in the military, in the government, that are anti-human elements that pose not just an existential threat to Russia, but to the rest of humanity. And in that regard, I think that what Russia is doing in Ukraine is a good thing. It's something I stand by. Of course, I realize that that comes with the toll of immiseration for Ukrainians, a lot of Ukrainians who are not of the Nazi bent, who just want to live peaceful, normal, for lack of a better term, lives. So I'm not a gung-ho champion of this military operation, but I understand its provenance, and I understand that it is rooting out very evil elements within Ukrainian society that, again, pose a threat not just to Russia, but to humanity as well. So, you know, that's the stance I've come to take with it. There are a lot of elements outside of that that I question with regard to the new multipolar order that is supposedly forming, and whether that is going to include justice for the people of Yemen, for example, or the people of Palestine. I think it remains to be seen, but there hasn't been much talk about that. So that's something I've been questioning, and I've gotten some flack for, but that's fine. When you're getting flack, then you're over the target, as they say. But all of that as a long way of leading up to my question, what is your assessment of what's been going on in Ukraine since February 24th? Obviously, this, what is going on, its origins are long before that. But what's your assessment of what's been going on with regard to Russia's military operation in Ukraine?
Yeah, I would largely agree with you. It's funny, like, I think it was in January, somebody floated me the, you know, there was this opportunity, the Russian council, the Russian government had been looking for foreign podcasters and journalists like us to, they would sponsor, you know, pay the trip, the all of the costs, the visas to fly to Russia and participate in some conferences like in February or March. And I just had been so tired of traveling. You know, I don't do PCR tests. I've never taken one. I refuse to do any of that. And so, I've been to Russia before, and I was like, oh, I'm not going through that again. Good, but it's funny because good thing I didn't go, because had I gone, like, I would have been stuck probably still in Russia. And back in 2017, I went to Russia for 3 weeks with, I don't know if you know Sharon Tennyson. She has the Center for Citizens Initiatives, an NGO, and she takes trips to promote U.S.-Russia relations, like peace diplomacy with American citizens.
Yes, I'm familiar with her.
Yeah, and Ray McGovern's been on that trip the year before I went. Mm-hmm. I went 2017. I went with Rick Sterling. I don't know if you know Rick Sterling. I was actually...
Yes.
Bunked together in the hotel. Actually, he's going to be on my TNT show next week. And
nice.
We met Gorbachev. I shook hands with Gorbachev, and we met Vladimir Posner and Andrei Kortunov and some other folks. I would just comment, like, the way I view this, I think it's important to go way back in history, and you get this broader view. And if you just look, like, it helps you make much more sense of what's going on. And you go back to like the 1800s, right? When the French, the Napoleon in the French Empire, when they invaded Russia, right? So you've got the 1800s and they failed, right? They went into during the winter. The Russians did the scorched earth, right? They burnt down like Moscow, and they just pulled back to the east and during the winter. And then Napoleon's troops just froze to death, right? They starved and froze to death. And so they failed. There was this intent always by the West, always trying to destroy Russia. And then in the 1900s, again, a century later, we all know Nazi Germany, Operation Barbarossa, I think it was 1941, I don't remember. Again, they failed, but that was also the West, you know, the U.S., British wanted to bleed Russia as well, and they didn't have any problem, you know, letting the dogs of war, the Nazi Germany, go ahead and bleed Russia. And so again, the Germans failed in the 1900s, and here we are again, right? The 2000s, and it's the same thing as you said: U.S., EU, NATO, using Ukraine as the battering ram against Russia. And so that's the way I see it. You see this clear historical trend every century for the past 300 years, trying to get at Russia. That's the big picture view. And I think they're just trying, they've been trying to subjugate Russia, and they haven't succeeded since February until now. I don't tend to follow the day-to-day action in Ukraine and Russia because it's just so much information, you know, it's like a full-time job and I don't have time for that. And you don't even know what to believe anymore, whether it's from, you know, whichever perspective, because whether, you know, we look at everything, I'm sure you do, Telegram, Twitter, alternative channels, alternative video platforms, you know, where we're pulling together all of this info. And, yeah, you have to read also the pro-Washington stuff. You have to read the pro-Russian stuff. And, it's really hard to tell what's going on. You get video clips that you don't know when they are from. They could be from years ago. They can be from other battlefields. You don't know the context. It could be manipulated. And so that's one reason I don't like to follow the daily stuff. I tend to follow the bigger markers that tell us where we are. Like, I don't know if you read Pepe Escobar's interview at the cradle of the Russian economist Sergei Glazyev.
I have not read that. I have not. I need to.
Yeah, I bookmarked it, and it took me a few days to find time to sit down and read it. It's not that long. But then he cites like Sergei Glazyev's article from a few years ago, and then his book, which is available in English. If you just read the article, and then you'll find the title of the book and you search it, and you'll get the entire English free. You can go to Glazyev's website and download it for free in English as a PDF. And it's just mind blowing. Like, he's talking about this new economic system in the East that that's forming, you know, digital currencies and all of this stuff that the global South will be able to use to default on their Western debt. You know, so I tend to find these kind of big, I tend to follow these type of big markers, you know, like what Glazyev's talking about when Putin says, I want rubles for oil. You know, these are the big geopolitical, geoeconomic shifts in the world order that are, for me, more important than the day-to-day. Because like I said, it's just, it's so intense. You've got people, like I'm sure you know, Eva, was it Bartlett? She's on the ground there in Donbass. That guy's name? The American Texas, he's in Donbass, the guy from Texas, Rich Bentley or something. Forgetting his name.
I know who you're talking about. There's also Patrick Lancaster, who's been doing excellent work. He has a YouTube channel. He's been in Donbass for quite some time. And he was the first journalist, to my knowledge, to publish the footage and photograph. I think he took a photograph as well of the woman who was found in Mariupol with a swastika that was either burnt or carved into her stomach. And then about a week after he published that footage, I mean, he was right there in the basement of a school in Mariupol that the Ukrainian forces had been using as a shelter, it seemed, and also apparently a torture chamber, given that this woman was found there in that condition. But he published that, and then about a week later, it was taken up by a Ukrainian government member, if I'm not mistaken, and spun so that it was blamed on the Russians, that Russian forces or forces affiliated with the Russians, the Chechens perhaps, had done this. Nobody was named in particular as the culprit, coming from the Ukrainian spin, but you know, that's a perfect example of what you're talking about how what I think very real information such as that provided by Patrick Lancaster gets minimal coverage when he puts it out, even though it's verifiable. It then gets spun a week later by Ukrainian propaganda, and the whole world believes that this is what Russia is doing to the people of Mariupol in this instance. And you add to that countless other examples, and it's maddening to go through. So Eva is a friend of mine, and she's been doing a great job parsing all of this. And I've looked to her Telegram channel a lot for an accurate assessment of the day-to-day. And Vanessa Bealey as well has been doing an excellent job. She's based in Syria, but she has a lot of experience with the Russian military, given that they've been in Syria helping the Assad government for quite some time. So she has some very keen insights into how they work, how they operate, how methodical they are. So she's been a good resource. Her Telegram channel and Eva's Telegram channel are good resources for trying to parse the day-to-day events that are happening in Ukraine. But I agree with you as well that I do like to know what's happening on a day-to-day level, but I agree with you that the big picture is just as, if not more important, especially the macroeconomic picture. And this is something I know you've spoken about with several guests, including Alex Craner, who's been on my show a few times, and he's actually coming on tomorrow. So I'm hoping to talk more about the macroeconomics of what's going on. But we have about a minute and a half until break here, but just to get it started, to get this conversation started for when we come back after the break, what is your, I guess quickly at this point, what is your sense of the announcements that have been made with regard to the emerging new multipolar order, or fair world order, as it's been put by some?
It's mixed. Like initially your offhand reaction is, and I get like a lot of people say like, it would be fair. Like in many ways we've been suffering from this American exceptionalism, these many unfair things that the American empire has, you know, the Anglo-American empire has been doing for a long time. So your first gut reaction would be like, yeah, awesome. Finally, you know, a bit of a balance, right? A balancing of the chessboard. But I also fear, I study a lot, you know, globalism, world government, and I'm preoccupied mm-hmm. with this. And my belief, which is related to my spiritual belief, is that we will end up ultimately with a tyrannical world government. And so we are now in this kind of unipolar world where the American empire, globalist American empire, is trying to push us into this unipolar global government. But I for me, having a multipolar system is also not some, you know, how would you say, necessarily a reprieve, that we could end up through the multipolar system also in that same destination of a world government that is tyrannical. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here. Like, again, it will benefit parts of the world, but I also see long term that it could equally be as dangerous.
Yes, I agree. And let's get into that after the break, because there's a lot to examine there. And I share your outlook as well. And I think that people with our outlook get accused of being pessimistic or cynical sometimes. Yeah. But I think it's a realistic outlook to have. But let's get into that after the break. So more with Hrvoje Morić, ladies and gentlemen, after this.
TNT Radio's Patrick Henningsen.
Her name is Marwa Osman, and she's also the host of a fantastic show on Press TV, Mideast Stream, one of the best geopolitical and foreign affairs analysts out there regarding the Middle East. Marwa, I was shocked when I saw this announcement. What's happening with this ceasefire right now? Is this the real deal? What can we expect to see?
Well, it's the real deal would be on the table when the siege is lifted, the aerial, the sea, and the land blockade. Once that is lifted, then we can begin talking about a real deal coming from the 7 years of aggression against Yemen, the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen, going into the 8th year since March 25th, since it started in March 25th, 2015. Basically, it was a Saudi approach after the big target that happened last week when the Yemeni armed forces targeted Aramco in Jeddah, and they targeted Tanura, which is the basically the port that has 80% of the Saudi oil exported out of Saudi Arabia. So they targeted those facilities, which damages a lot Saudi economic interests, and also affects the actual price of oil worldwide.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
You better lock up your sons when the ex-girls hit town. We're an irresistible force. We have the power to get whatever and whoever we want. Let's go. Time to find somewhere hot. We cut through the traffic. No one can stand in our way. Wait there. Don't move a muscle, the paramedic said.
The driver said I just ran out in front of him. I can't remember anything, but I've been told I'll be on crutches for a while, and my miniskirt-wearing days are over.
Too much alcohol makes you feel invincible when you're most vulnerable. At least 77% of pedestrians killed in road accidents at night had been drinking. Alcohol. Know your limits.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
If you want the jibby jab,
all right, enough.
Then you've come to the wrong station. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, your host for the rest of the hour. And I've been speaking with my TNT colleague, Hrvoje Morić. He has his own show on TNT Radio, which airs from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And I'm delighted to say that I will be a guest on his show this evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And Hrvoje actually reached out to me first to invite me on to his show. And given that he is somebody I've wanted to speak to for quite some time, I reciprocated the invitation, and serendipitously, as good things tend to work out, this worked out this way. So he is now with me on my show, and I will be with him later today, this evening, Eastern time. So we've been talking about Ukraine, and before the break, we were getting into the macroeconomic picture of what is likely to, or perhaps going to, result from what's been happening in Ukraine. And there's been talk of the emergence of a multipolar order. Certainly a new geopolitical order is emerging. Whether it's going to be multipolar and fair is still an open question, in my opinion. And Hrvoje, before the break, you were starting to speak about how all governments tend toward authoritarianism. And I think any student of history can see that that's a truth. That's a historical truth. And it should be something that worries us when we hear these very sanguine proclamations of a new multipolar order, a fair world order. Of course, it's something that you and I and many other people would like to see, but we have to be careful not to get too far ahead of ourselves in celebrating, especially when there are still things on the table like digital currencies, central bank digital currencies to be specific. And then also, we are still talking about debt-based economies. Russia's debt to GDP is very low compared to the US's debt to GDP ratio, 19% to something like 135%. Although for the US, the number is likely a lot higher. And then China as well is also a debt-based economy. And as a previous guest, Fabio Vigi, has pointed out that, you know, debt-based economies really only head in one direction, and that's accruing further debt. So, you know, that's something to temper our optimism about this multipolar order that may be emerging. So what are your thoughts on that? Can you add to that and perhaps expand upon what you were saying before we went to break?
I just had a few comments from before. I think I shared your interview with Fabio, and I've bookmarked it. I've been meaning to listen to it. I haven't had the time yet. And you mentioned Alex Krainer before. He's also one of my paisanos. He's a fellow Croatian. He served in the Croatian military, and he got me my first. I'm on two YouTube bans, two YouTube strikes currently, and he got me my first. I don't blame him. I just laugh at the whole situation. It's ridiculous. But I interviewed him, and he said that he thought COVID-1984 and Ukraine are part of the same problem, and I would agree. And he used the term. He said fake pandemic, and that, you know, the algorithms picked that up and got me canned. And I also thought it was funny. I noticed last week, April 14th, that you interviewed Cynthia Chung the same day that I did. It's just funny. So I would add, I guess, about the multipolar thing. Again, I've been coming at this for a long time. I'm obsessed with studying global governance, globalism, basically world government, because I even had a website. You know, I began teaching in Mexico 2010, and then I wanted to just learn more about this stuff and produce content. You know, I just started Skyping. I wanted to talk to smart people, because there were not, and still are not, that many people around me that are interested in the things that you and I, and, you know, that a lot of us want to know about. And so I needed to find a way to talk to these smart people. So I just used my students and classes as an excuse to, we Skyped in, you know, Paul Craig Roberts, Ray McGovern, James Bamford, people like John Perkins, the economic hitman. And so I just would throw them up on a random YouTube channel. And then finally I created Geopolitics and Empire. And then back then I created my first website, which was called Global Governance Archive or something like that, where I kind of wanted to pull together all of the best websites on, you know, war and economy and globalism. And it got a lot of views the first few months, but I decided to kill the website because I just didn't have time to keep it up, you know, having a full-time job. But my view on this is, because I'm a Christian, I believe in the Bible and the prophecy and all of that. And, you know, in the book of Daniel and book of Revelation, it talks about, you know, in the end times, whenever that is, nobody knows exactly. Could be soon. It could be in the century. I don't know. But it talks about having a world government. You know, a lot of people have read this, you know, where it will take control of all nations and people groups and languages, things like that. So it's implying that there will be a world system, a world government, and that if you know, the mark of the beast thing, the way I interpret that is that, you know, you won't be able to buy or sell unless you submit to the dictates of this system, right? Of this tyrannical system, you won't be able to buy or sell whatever those dictates become. And then you can just kind of deduce, so well, if it's Satan, then he's, you know, all of the things that is related to evil and bad stuff, you will have to agree with. And if you're against it, well, then you'll be locked out of the system. So that's kind of my view. And then you study this move towards global government that's been around for well over a century. You know, Matthew Arendt recently wrote about Cecil Rhodes. You know, that's one of the people I've been studying. Cecil Rhodes, he left his will. He wanted to create a world commonwealth, basically starting with the British Commonwealth and then to create a world government. And they have many, many different plans. You know, they talked about in 1939, this idea of the Atlantic Union to unify Europe and the U.S. into one supranational union. But, you know, all of these different ways to get to world government. And that's, I think, that's where we are going. For me, it's very visible. And, you know, recently we had the World Government Summit. A lot of people are aware of that. I've been following that from like its inception, like 5 years ago, because, again, my primary obsession is studying global governance, world government. And, you know, they said recently you had the head of the Atlantic Council, by the way, who helped get me, you know, they wrote an article about me last year, which got my Patreon terminated, the Atlantic Council.
The AP had something to do with that as well, right?
Yeah, it was co-written. It was an AP article that described my because I did the first interview with Francis Boyle, even though some people claim that they did it first. I did this document that they traced how that went viral. You know, first Boyle sent onto his email list his view, and then he gave the interview to me first, and then that got picked up by Great Game India. And then it got onto like Alex Jones's InfoWars, and then it went viral. But the head of Atlantic Council at the World Government Summit was saying that the current globalization is breaking down. Everybody sees that. Supply chain is breaking down. We are deglobalizing temporarily. Things are rearranging. And he said we're going into regionalism, regional integration, whatever you want to call it. And he literally says that that will form the basis of world governance. I mean, basically world government. And this is for 20 years how I've been seeing it, that the EU, the EU is a technocracy. It's see it as an amalgamation of Soviet dictatorial communism and Nazi fascism and technocracy. You had the dissident Bukowski, who called the EU the new European Soviet. We know that the EU has... Brussels has Nazi roots. Dr. Rath, this German doctor, has written a book about this. And it's a technocracy, totally anti-democratic. Even Jean Monnet, in some of his letters, I think, talks about how it's anti-democratic. It's blatant to see. And that's the model of world government, because it has brought 28 nation states into this supranational, you know, Babylon-like structure where you create one government, one economic structure, one political structure, trying to make one cultural structure. And they're they want to replicate this for all regions of the world. You already have an African Union. You already have a South American Union. Literally, it's called South American Union, UNASUR in Spanish. I think the The Abraham Accords are paving the way for a Middle Eastern Union. The CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, many years ago wrote an article, titled Middle Eastern Union. You've got ASEAN, the Union of Southeast Asian States. Putin's or Nazarbayev's. Supposedly, it was Nazarbayev's idea in 1994 of the Eurasian Union. Right now, it's the Eurasian Economic Union. But it always begins, like the EU began as an economic trade agreement, and then it builds into a political, you know, unified structure. And so regarding the multipolar world, I can easily see us that this is the way towards world government. Because if you're trying to force this American unipolar, you know, if the American unipolar world is trying to push the rest of us into this world government, it's going to be very lopsided, right? It's like America's right. going to be controlling all of the other countries. It's actually makes more sense if you level things out. It becomes this multipolar world where all countries are like on a level playing field, right? And they all plug into this centralized global control system, right? World government. I feel that will actually lead us quicker to world government because you've got the WHO pandemic treaty, for example. So imagine that we're all leveled out. The U.S. lowers its status in terms of economic and military might. And, you know, you've got Russia and everyone's at the table equally, right? But then we signed this WHO treaty. And then you've got these international institutions now controlling all of the nations of the world, you know, telling us what to do. And there you are. You're in this tyrannical world government. So I don't see how the multipolar world will save us. I actually think it's going to take us faster to that destination.
Yeah, I agree. And I temper my outlook with the statement that obviously, none of us can predict the future, and it remains to be seen. But we can look at history, as you just laid out, and see where these sort of economic blocks and let's be honest, that's what they are first and foremost. They're economic blocks. We can see what they lead to, no matter what pretenses they might make toward multipolarity or unity or anti-authoritarianism. And I think that when people like Matthew Errett, who's been a guest on both of our shows, and he's somebody for whom I have a lot of respect. I respect his work. I think he's an extremely generous, sincere, just stand-up guy. He takes a very optimistic view of what may be emerging. And I think that in his argument, there is a lot that holds water. But there are also a lot of things that I am skeptical about. So this is one of the things stemming from what's been happening in Ukraine that's been really maddening to me to try to figure out, because there are signals coming from all sides and it's hard to know what to make of it. But it seems that, you know, global governance is the order of the day, and an Eastern form of that may take shape and look different in a lot of ways and operate differently in a lot of ways than a Western form of it. But I think that one thing we can all agree on is that the West is 100% on board with global governance, and that it is intentionally committing economic suicide right now in furtherance of what I think is a plan to tear down what's left of the existing economic system that Western Empire has, so that it can build it back up in the image of the Great Reset or Build Back Better. And I don't think that the World Economic Forum is driving this. I think they're a major player, but who is driving this is the International Bank. banking cartel. And this is what they need to happen. Alex Craner has laid this out very succinctly, that Western Empire is starved for capital, both financial capital and human capital. And it knows that the system, economic system it has now, is in a death spiral, and it has to do something, anything to recalibrate that, if you will. And I think that that's why we see these Western countries now just in tandem going for broke with sending massive amounts of arms shipments to Ukraine, this massive military spending, for example, this willingness to put citizenry at risk with regard to access to energy, to heating, to electricity. I think the West is really going for broke with regard to this this great reset agenda that is driven by the international banking cartel and then distributed in a public relations way through bodies like the Economic Forum. I think this is plain as day to see, but what is your take on that?
I would just say early 2020, it was the first time I connected with Alex Craner. And for me, it was a lot of seminal interviews in early 2020, you know, with Francis Boyle, with CJ Hopkins. I think CJ said I was like one of the first to do a video interview with him, Robin Minotti, Alex Craner.
And Robin's
he
great.
Really, yeah. And he, and, yeah, Alex said it at the time that like, this is it. This is the battle. It's like Lord of the Rings, you know, we're going full Orwell. And I would just add that we have to get out of this nation state framework. You know, these global elites have no allegiance to nation states. So this whole Russia mm-hmm. versus China versus US, it does, you know, to some point it makes sense. But then you have to go beyond that, because these people, and for a long time, many people have written books about this and commented on this, that they don't care about America or whatever. They use it. And then they like a snake that sheds its skin, they dispose of it. You know, you think of all of these people, like they use Saddam and then they toss them. You know, they use mm-hmm. whoever they want and then they toss them. And I just recall the quote.
Zelensky.
So, yeah, there you go. And I had a guest on yesterday who's got a big Twitter channel, the peasant journalist on TNT. His name is Phil Gibson. And he finds all these little gems, all these old clips of all this like globalists saying all this crazy stuff. And he put Kissinger out. Kissinger was talking about world peace and basically world government, and citing Immanuel Kant, right, from centuries ago, the great thinker. And then I recall that I went on his website. I went on this website. I think it's from like Harvard or something. They have some good resources there. And Immanuel Kant was a proponent of world government. And he said the way this would happen, well, he criticized the aspect that it could become tyrannical. So he recognized that. But he also said that for this to happen, all of the world's countries would have to become like republics and then form a federation. So again, we kind of see this trend, you know what I'm saying, where all of the nations have to become nominally, right, democratic, quote, republics. And that's what we've seen the U.S. kind of doing. They've gone around the world smashing countries and then trying mm-hmm. to like nominally, you know, put in some puppet like Zelensky. There you go, Ukraine example. You know, you had Ukraine before. It wasn't playing along with this globalist global government system. It was too sovereign or independent, you know, Syria under Assad or whatever. So they got to go right. in and smash it and then put in a new puppet. And there's your fake democratic republic, which then will be plugged in to the global governance system. And regarding the United States, I've had on a number of guests before, which I would agree with, that it's in a way, as much bad that it has done, it's sort of the last bastion of possible opposition to, even though it's been promoting simultaneously globalism, right? America, Washington, the structure of the American Republic. You know, there's still a little bit of that constitution left. There's still the possibility that Patriots, there could be some revolution or something, and Patriots could come back to power and take hold of the American Republic and hit against the New World Order, you know, like salvage the American Republic. Because of those, you know, I would view it as, you know, conservative Christian values and individualism and, you know, liberty and all of that. So I think in that sense, America is the last bastion of freedom. But I think things are just so far gone, and that's why they want to destroy any possibility of anyone being able to take the reins again of the American Republic. And so once they take down America, it's like there's no more opposition to this world government. You know what I'm saying? Like, you've got China, which is authoritarian. Many other countries are destroyed, like, you know, in the global south, you know, in Latin America. I mean, who's going to fight back? Right. What economic, military, political power is there? So that's the way I see it.
Yeah, this is something, what you're saying is very similar to something I was speaking about with my guest yesterday, Issa Bloomi, whom I know you've spoken with.
Yeah, a few weeks ago. Yeah, I talked to him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy, a friend as well as a colleague, I'm happy to say. And we've been having a series of conversations just about every week on this program that focus on Arabia and how what's happening in the rest of the world affects Arab countries, and then how Arab countries are responding to that. And yesterday we had a very somber conversation about how there's really no resistance or not much resistance left in the Arab world to put up a fight against global governance. We do see it in Yemen with in the form of Ansar Allah fighting back against the genocidal war that the Saudi, UAE, Qatar, US, UK, France have been waging on it for 7+ years now. And we see Hezbollah, for example, in Lebanon, and to some extent, Hamas in Palestine. But, you know, these are relatively, I don't want to say powerless, but up against the military might of Western Empire, you know, they are much smaller forces in comparison. And, you know, it seems that nobody is standing up or standing with these indigenous resistance movements to both globalism and empire. And, you know, that's one of the things I've been pointing out with regard to Russia, is that when it comes to Yemen, it's fully on board with aiding and abetting the genocidal war against Yemen. It voted in the UN to label Ansar Allah a terrorist movement. It voted recently for an arms embargo against all of Ansar Allah, not just its leaders, so that this indigenous movement can't defend itself in this genocidal war. And, you know, it leads me again to the question. So if this new multipolar order emerges, how much is it going to, if at all, include these indigenous resistance movements that we see in the Arab world, but also in Latin America and other parts of the so-called global South? So a lot of open questions there, and a lot of questions that people unfortunately aren't asking. And it's frustrating to see them not asking those questions and to even get angry with you for asking those questions. Yeah. Unfortunately, I took up the rest of our time there with that. But perhaps some food for thought to leave us off with that we might be able to pick up with later today or tonight when we speak. But Hrvoje, I thank you very much for coming on and spending the time with me today to share your insights, and I look forward to speaking with you a bit later today on your program.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and see you in a bit.
Absolutely. Take care, and everybody stick around. The Misty Winston Show is up next, and I will be back tomorrow at the same time.